Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I know you all love it when I bring you a story you haven't heard before. We all like the classic serial killer stories and the very famous true crime stories, but it's always interesting and educational to hear a new story. Well, I can promise you, unless you're one of very few people, you have not heard this story before. This story is about an interstate murder spree committed by some very unlikely criminals who crossed paths to become a killing team. They were heartless, vicious people who had no care or concern for human life and who killed simply to get something they wanted or for the thrill of it. It sounds like I'm talking about hardened criminals, right? Dangerous men with dangerous pasts on a murderous rampage? No. That might be easier to understand, but today we are talking about a boy, a child, really, who did terrible things and believed he could never be held accountable for a reason that you will find incredible. Not only is this a story you've never heard, but today it's going to be told in large part by the prosecuting attorney on this case, my father, who knows every detail of these awful events that have been mostly forgotten and lost to time. This is the story of Lawrence Leroy Alexander. Let's get into it. September 22nd, 1975. A man is driving down the highway in Siskiyou County, California, which is located near the northernmost border of California. He sees something very out of place, and he slows his car to take a look. There, he finds the body of 23-year-old Dunsmuir resident Russell Middleton. Russell had been shot and killed with a high-powered rifle at close range. Russell was a brakeman for the Southern Pacific Railroad. He was a hard worker, and he had a lot of friends in the area. On the night of September 21st, 1975, Russell had been playing pool at Nightcap's Bar in Weed, California. He kept losing the pool games, and he had racked up a small gambling debt because of those losses to a man known only as Greg. This was the man he was playing against. Greg told other people in the bar that night that he had come from Colorado and he was headed to Wickiup Reservoir to go fishing. As they played pool together, Russell told Greg that he needed to drive to Klamath Falls, Oregon, to pick up his wife. And because Greg was headed that way as well, the two men decided to go together. Russell and Greg left the bar around 8:15 in their own vehicles, headed out to look for a place where Russell could cash his paycheck in order to pay Greg the money he owed him on the gambling debt. People saw the men together getting fuel at the Phillips 66 station on Weed Boulevard. That was the last time Russell was seen alive. Who was this man, known only as Greg? He was actually William Broderick, and he was a dangerous man. As soon as Russell's body was found, the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office issued an all-points bulletin to be on the lookout for the car that Greg was driving. It was a Jeep CJ5, and it was last seen at a motel in Klamath Falls. The man driving the Jeep had checked into that motel under the name Greg Johansson. The day after Russell's body was found, an Oregon State game warden, aware of the APB, saw William Broderick, a.k.a. Greg Johansson, fishing at the Wickiup Reservoir. He approached William and could clearly see, inside his Jeep, a rifle sitting between the front seats. The trooper called this in, and dispatch returned a felony warrant that was issued prior for a probation violation. So Greg, William Broderick, was a wanted man. He had a conviction out of Multnomah County, and that was enough for the officer to place William Broderick under arrest. After he was in custody, it was found that William had come from Colorado by way of Las Vegas and had stolen the Jeep in Wyoming a few weeks prior to the murder. He had also stolen the .30-30 carbine rifle along with the .22 pistol that was also found in the Jeep. The Oregon State Police then searched Williams' hotel room and found more guns, and one of those was matched to the bullets that killed Russell Middleton. Really quite a sad story. This guy just playing pool in a bar, meets somebody, goes to cash his check, not knowing that this guy is going to kill him for his paycheck. On a hunch, one of the officers called Las Vegas Metro and found out that there had been a string of robberies along with a murder during the time William Broderick was in Las Vegas, and a Jeep matching the one William was driving was seen at the robberies. William Broderick knew he was caught, and he admitted that, yes, he had committed the two armed robberies and the homicide in Las Vegas a week earlier. He pled guilty to first-degree murder in exchange for a sentence of 25 years to life. As William sat in prison, he began to talk. He had been committing crimes, very serious crimes, for a long time. Robberies in Oregon, Wyoming, Colorado, and in Utah. During one of these robbery sprees, he had picked up a hitchhiker near the border of Utah and Colorado. The hitchhiker? Lawrence Leroy Alexander, who was only 15 years old. Lawrence Leroy Alexander was from Kingston, New York. He had been labeled as incorrigible and was sent to what was called the New York Industrial School. It was, in effect, a prison for teenagers. He escaped from that school and he ran with no real plan or direction in mind. I looked and I looked and I looked, but I could not find a single photo of Lawrence Leroy Alexander. We know that Lawrence had been a problem as a kid. He got in fights, he stole things, and he was violent. But no one had any idea, not a clue, as to just how violent or how dangerous this boy was. September 14th, 1975. A few weeks prior to the events we just talked about, William Broderick, remember he had been calling himself Greg, but now we're calling him William, had stopped and picked up Lawrence Leroy Alexander as he hitchhiked, and they were driving through Utah when they offered a ride to a drifter named Dwayne Schoer. Poor Dwayne had no way of knowing that William and Lawrence Leroy Alexander had already discussed what they were going to do with him. They picked Dwayne up, and then William turned to Dwayne and demanded that he hand over all the cash he had along with his coat. After robbing him, William ordered Dwayne to start walking into the desert. As Dwayne walked, William, being the coward he is, fired his .22 caliber pistol at the man's back. He then gave the pistol to Lawrence Leroy Alexander and said to him, "Finish him off." Lawrence then shot Dwayne in the back of the head. When he was shot, he fell across a fence and it broke his hyoid bone, which is usually signs of strangulation. William and Lawrence then drove to Las Vegas and stayed here in the Apache Motel. This place doesn't exist anymore, but it was down on Main Street back then. The two stayed the night, and when they checked out, they left Dwayne's bedroll that they had stolen from him behind in the motel room. On the morning of September 15th, the duo decided they needed some cash, and as they looked around the area, they saw an adult bookstore. William and Lawrence walked into the store, pointed a gun at the clerks, and demanded everything out of the register. They didn't get much cash, and they decided they had to hit another place before leaving town. They drove here to the Desert Hills Motel a couple of hours after robbing the adult bookstore and spending some of the money from that robbery. I love these vintage photos of the old Vegas motels, and the Desert Hills is still there. I know right where this is at. It's down on the end of Fremont. I used to drive by it every time I went to my storage unit. It's a little run down at this point, as you can imagine. William and Lawrence got some cash from the Desert Hills robbery, and about 20 minutes later, they decided to go here, to the Ye King's Rest Motel, which used to sit on the Strip. If you're familiar with Las Vegas, it's just off Clark, kind of by the courthouse district. Their plan was to case the motel to see if it was a good location to rob. But as William and Lawrence walked up to the lobby, Lawrence hadn't yet put the pistol in his pocket. And the manager behind the desk in the lobby, his name was Walter Bannister, he saw the gun and he knew what was about to happen. Walter was in a wheelchair. He was a tough old guy, and he had told his friends that there had been some robberies in the area, and he would not allow himself to be robbed. So he hurriedly wheeled himself over to the door. It was a glass door, and he closed it, but it was too late for him. Lawrence Leroy Alexander, this child monster, pointed his pistol at Walter and shot him in the chest, killing him. William and Lawrence ran back to the stolen Jeep and jumped in. Several witnesses to the shooting got in their vehicles and chased the Jeep, but William was able to elude them, and soon he had lost all of the people that were tailing him. William and Lawrence drove out of Las Vegas and into California. They spent a couple of days together, and then on September 19th, 1975, they decided to split up near Taft in Kern County, California. William headed north to San Francisco and then to Weed, which is where he met Russell Middleton, unfortunately for Russell. So we know what happened to William Broderick. He was caught. He was arrested. He is currently 69 years old and still sitting in prison in California. As you can see here on this long list of parole hearings and reviews, he has been denied parole each and every time he sat before the parole board. William Gregory Broderick will most likely die in prison. Now, when I tell you there is absolutely nothing online about Lawrence Leroy Alexander, I have actually never come across a case, let alone covered a case, with nothing online about the perpetrator before. The only time the name Lawrence Leroy Alexander is even mentioned anywhere online is in connection to William Broderick. So I feel really fortunate to have my father's personal experience to memorialize this case forever here on YouTube, because it will most likely be the only record of these events, especially some of the personal details he's going to share with you. My dad came prepared for his interview with a little handwritten page of notes, writing only he can understand, decipher, whatever you want to call it. You cannot read his handwriting. But what's funny about my dad is that once he starts recounting these cases, he kind of goes on autopilot. You'll see it. He gets kind of a distant look in his eyes and stares off at nothing, and it all comes back to him, which I find fascinating because to me, it's a look into how seriously he took all of these cases, how he put every single detail of them into his brain, his computer, and now almost 50 years later can still remember little details, even when he says, oh, I don't remember much. Yes, he does. In fact, partway through his story, he says, well, they had a 30-aught gun. I was kind of blown away by that because I had read in the articles that it was a 30-aught gun, but I couldn't believe my dad remembered that. It was just buried there in the computer amongst the thousands and thousands of cases he has prosecuted and then worked on in private practice as an attorney before becoming a judge in 1995. Judges are held to very high standards. They have to be beyond reproach. Their ethics cannot be in question, and my father took his job as a judge very seriously, and he remembers all these little details. He is now retired, and after sitting on the Judicial Review Board, currently sits on the Legislative Ethics Committee for Utah, meaning he reviews complaints that are lodged against elected officials. Anyway, I just find it fascinating that at 77 years old, he can remember so many details from almost 50 years ago. This is quite a fascinating story and has some forensic details that are pretty impressive for 1975, along with a kind of scary event that happened in the courtroom one day.
My name is Hans Chamberlain. I'm 77 years old, but back in the 1970s, I was the prosecuting attorney for Iron County in Utah, which is a small community located in southern Utah, about 3 hours away from Las Vegas, Nevada. While I was a prosecutor, we received a call from a detective in New York State who indicated that he had had a young man walk into the police station and stated that he had killed an individual in Utah together with another younger man and left the body by the freeway fence in Iron County. When asked about how long ago this was, young man named Lawrence Leroy Alexander said that the body had been there probably 6 weeks. Unfortunately, no one had discovered it, although it was literally within about 70 feet from a freeway off-ramp in a rural area in southern Utah, just laying face down against a fence. So the detective thought the young man was credible, so we immediately sent out the Iron County Sheriff's Office, the Highway Patrol, to start searching all of the exits along I-15 between Cedar City and St. George, Utah, which is about 50 miles south of Cedar City. Within an hour, I received a phone call that a body had been discovered laying face down along the freeway in the off-ramp that services Canaryville, Utah. As a prosecuting attorney, I'm required to go out to all unattended deaths. And of course, we assume now that this was a murder scene. So we proceeded out there. I went with the police officers, walked up to the area where the body was lying, and the body was in a very bad state of decomposition, had been there for probably 6 weeks, and had been there all of August and, as I recall, part of September. So we looked the area over, noticed that it was laying right against the freeway fence, and so we removed the body. There was no identification on the body of any kind. The body did not have any, didn't have a coat or anything on it. But when this youth named DeLawrence Leroy Alexander confessed to the detective in New York, he had a coat on. And that detective was wise enough to take the youth's coat for evidence. And later we sent that coat in to the lab and they discovered hair follicles on that coat that were later identified as very close to Lawrence Leroy Alexander's hair sample, which he had to give under the law. The hair follicle that was removed was not Lawrence Leroy Alexander's. It was the victim's, Dwayne Shore, who was with Lawrence Leroy Alexander at the time he committed this murder. Alexander told the detective back in New York that they had were traveling together. They hooked up at the Utah-Wyoming border. William Broderick stole the Jeep that had a firearm in it, and then they proceeded to travel from Wyoming towards Las Vegas through Utah on I-70 and then connecting on I-15 that goes on to Las Vegas and on to California. They started to talk, and they just decided among themselves that they would pick up the next hitchhiker, rob him at some point, and then execute him, kill him, which is was very callous, especially for a 14, 15-year-old kid. Lawrence Leroy Alexander had escaped from a youth facility in New York at age 14, and when he committed this homicide and was brought back to Utah, he was age 15. Alexander thought that he would not be tried as an adult because in the state of New York, a youth under 16 cannot be tried as an adult. However, in Utah, the law was different. In Utah, a youth under the age of 16 can be certified to stand trial as an adult. And so Alexander thought he was going to get away with it by confessing to this murder and receive some attention and some notoriety and would be in the newspapers. Unfortunately, he didn't realize that the laws in our nation are different in each jurisdiction, and Utah just happened to be one of the states where youth under the age of 16 can be tried as an adult. So he was, of course, arrested when he went in and made the confession. He was brought back to Utah, had told the detective that when they decided to stop and rob this Dwayne Shore, that they would just stop along the side of the freeway to tell him to take his valuables, whatever they had. And I remember in the confession, Alexander said, we just kicked him out of the Jeep, said, take off your coat. And then he started to run up the side hill, which there's a little bit of a slope because it was an off-ramp down below the freeway level. And as he ran up the side of the hill, which was only about 50 feet or so, they started to shoot him in the back. And he stumbled and fell and hit the freeway fence, which was barbed wire on the top and heavy wire on the bottom. And that's important because when the autopsy was done, the deceased, the victim's hyoid bone was broken, which is normally a sign of strangulation. But in this case, it was broken when he hit the fence running fairly fast as he was trying to escape this gunfire. He, Alexander, then took the gun and walked up to the victim laying on against the fence and shot him in the head and finished him off, essentially. Interestingly, they were standing on the asphalt as they were shooting at the victim as he was running up to try to get away, and the shells were kicking out of the gun, and they landed on the asphalt. That became important because we had to place the time of death. And so I had the Utah Department of Transportation check to see when the white lines on the freeway were painted, because the shell casings had white paint on. And so we were able to place the exact time when that paint was applied, which was within 3 or 4 days of when the shooting took place. And it's even quite amazing that those painting the stripes did not see the body. Quite frankly, if you would have stopped with your windows rolled down at the stop sign at the off-ramp, you would have likely smelled the body, but no one apparently did, and it just laid there and decomposed. There was no identification on the victim and no way to know who he was. So we called the FBI lab back in Virginia, and they asked the person performing the autopsy in Salt Lake to remove the hands by cutting the hands off, and then sent them back to Quantico, Virginia, as I recall, where they were able to inflate the fingertips by some method with saline or something, and then roll the fingertips. As soon as that was done, the victim was identified, and we knew who he was. I had the unfortunate duty to call his parents and tell them that their son had been murdered in Utah. And of course, they were very upset and very sad. They hadn't heard from or seen him in several months, so they were very upset about that. So another thing that's interesting in this case is that we had to also, in Utah and other states, you cannot just convict someone on their confession. And so we had to place Lawrence Leroy Alexander at the scene. We had him in custody, but all we had at that point in time was the confession. The shell casings didn't show or indicate any fingerprints. So fortunately, the detective had taken the coat, and the coat ended up having the victim's hair on it, which could be identified through expert testimony as coming from the victim. And of course, Lawrence Leroy Alexander had the victim's coat on when he was arrested and was taken by the detective back there. Lawrence Leroy Alexander thought that he was going to get off with this murder because he was underage. So we held him. We held what's called a certification hearing to determine whether or not he should stand trial as an adult. That's before a judge. The detective came back, flew back. We had him fly back 2 or 3 times. And he came back and testified for us at that hearing. But at the certification hearing, something quite unusual happened. It was in a newer courthouse in Parowan, Utah, which was the county seat, which was the courtroom was enclosed with no windows. I was seated at the table, and right across from me at the next table on my left was Lawrence Leroy Alexander. Next to him was a deputy sheriff with a loaded firearm on his right-hand side. The power went off. The courtroom went completely black, And I immediately took the person next to me, put him under the table. I crawled under the table because I thought Alexander would go for the deputy's gun and we would have another homicide committed in the courtroom. The lights were off for about 2 minutes and then the generator kicked in. The lights came back on and he was just sitting there. Some of us were under the table thinking that, you know, our lives might be in danger, but fortunately he didn't try to go for the deputy's gun. And I count that as one of the many blessings that happened during that trial. He was appointed a public defender who vigorously defended him, tried to get some of the evidence suppressed, tried to get his confession suppressed, which was denied by the judge. And so as we got closer to trial, the evidence was quite persuasive. His own testimony, we could connect him to the scene through his hair, his confession, and ultimately he admitted prior to trial his involvement and was convicted of manslaughter or homicide. It was some, I'm not sure exactly if it was a murder or, in my recollection, it was second degree murder, but I've read in other reports that it was manslaughter, which I dispute, and pretty sure he was convicted of second degree murder. At his sentencing, the judge, who was J. Harlan Burns, indicated that he understood that the youth was young. He was a young individual, but had no alternative but to send him to the Utah State Prison because this was a very heinous crime. The other thing that came out at the time of sentencing, and based on Alexander's confession, was the fact that he admitted that he and this other individual that was with him, went on to Las Vegas the next day, shot and killed a motel clerk who was in a wheelchair through a plate glass window, killed him, and then robbed one of the motels on the Strip, the old Desert Inn on the Strip, and committed that armed robbery. So in a period of 3 or 4 days, they had killed 3 people in Utah, Oregon, and Nevada. When Lawrence Leroy Alexander was sentenced, he was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in the Utah State Prison. At the time he went to prison, he was the youngest inmate in the Utah State Prison system, which was very unusual, but that's where he deserved to be. And, you know, taking he took at least 2 lives that we know of. And unfortunate for him, unfortunate for the victims, but justice needed to be satisfied, and in his case, it was.
Like you heard my father say, we do not know what happened to Lawrence Leroy Alexander. I searched for hours online. I went through inmate records in Utah, in Nevada, California, and even in New York. I couldn't find anything for an inmate with the name of Lawrence Leroy Alexander, born around 1955. We simply do not know what happened to this killer, this boy murderer. My father feels that it is most likely he served time in Utah. How much, we don't know. Only the very old prison archives would have that information. And then he was turned over to Nevada for prosecution for the murder of Walter Bannister. Now, again, we don't know that this happened, but that is what usually happens in situations like this. This is a sad story, but one that I find very interesting because it begs the question, was Lawrence Leroy Alexander a natural-born killer, or did he become a killer because he happened to meet up with another killer? Was he destined to become a murderer? Obviously, he had it in him. There is no question about that. He had no trouble taking a life. And like my father said, that's particularly disturbing for someone so young. But for me, these existential questions are what draw me to true crime stories. What if someone else had picked up Lawrence Leroy Alexander when he was hitchhiking? Someone other than a killer. What if he'd been picked up by a nice family that took him in and cared for him, loved him, and fed him, and clothed him? Would he have become an upstanding member of society? Or would the whole family have ended up dead? We will never know, but it is fascinating to explore the possibility, and I'm grateful to have this story documented. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video and subscribe to my channel if you'd like to support me. You can also join my Patreon, and the end goal there is to raise money for cold case DNA testing. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.